in a few moments be hoping I'd left this turned off. But it is great to be here with you, and it's also a privilege to be able to speak to you this evening on a subject which I've been thinking a lot about for the last 5 years. Let me just try to give sort of a bit of a personal world of introduction before I actually jump in. And I'm going to try and say what I'm going to say as concisely as I can, because I'd really love to give as much time for you to be able to question me, whether it's to probe deeper or to challenge or to add something in. I always find I learn a lot from these events and tend to learn maybe even more than I've actually given away myself. But I was raised most of my childhood in the Middle East. And you can't grow up in a country like Saudi Arabia without being politically aware of all of the tensions and the rivalries that run. In the Middle East, there's a little saying from that part of the world, me against my brother and I against my cousin, me, my brother, and my cousin against the world. And that really governs an awful lot of Middle Eastern politics. And the question is, who are my brothers, who are my cousins, and who's the rest of the world? And the challenge is, those definitions are continually changing. At the same time, my mother is from a small country called Cyprus, which has the dubious honor of having the last divided capital city in the world that has a United Nations green line running straight through the middle of it. It's a country that's been under almost continual occupation by some other country for the last 3,500 years. The Hittites, the Persians, the Arabians, the Neo-Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, the Romans, until Mark Antony, the Caesar, gave it as a love gift to Cleopatra. I mean, you think giving diamonds is a big deal. Imagine giving someone a whole country. And then imagine how the people in the country felt about being given away as a love gift to someone else. And then all the way through, down through the Ottomans and so on. And right now, it is probably known, it's known within diplomatic circles as the diplomatic graveyard, a totally intractable problem that no one seems able to solve, with a lot of animosity on both sides. So I grew up in a part of the world, and also with a very strong family background, of being just aware of what happens, what's it like to live in a place where there's just long-term, intractable situations which are never reconciled, and indeed are very, very difficult to live with. And so that's just some of my personal background. Now, about 5 years ago, I sort of began sort of just wondering about what was happening in some of British culture and some of the American culture, and I began to think the same question that you heard just raised now. Why is it that so many people are angry? And initially, I thought I was talking about looking at a UK-US problem, and I was invited to speak to a group of members of the European Parliament. And after I'd finished speaking to them, I had people coming up to me from almost every member state of the EU saying, how do you understand what's happening in my country so well? You have to come and speak to our leadership there. And I can remember thinking, okay, it's obviously not just a UK-US problem, this is European-wide. And then a few months later, after that, I was speaking in Asia to leaders from 17 different countries across Asia. So as far north as Japan, China, running all the way down to New Zealand, Australia, and all the other countries in between. And I gave a Western example 5 years ago of what I want to share with you now, and then was amazed when, again, I was approached by every business leader in the room and every political leader saying, you understand my country so well, you have to come and speak to my country. A few weeks after that, I was back in my hometown of Oxford, and I was invited out for dinner with a leading African businessman who wanted to talk about what's happening in Sudan and South Sudan. Again, another very easily problem to address, very simple. And we were meant to meet for half an hour, and we met for 3.5 hours. And at the end, he said, I want you to meet with the leaders in both of those countries and in the neighboring countries, because what you're describing is exactly what's going on in the heart of our country. And then all of a sudden, people writing to me from South America saying, what you're describing is happening in Brazil, in Peru, in Argentina, and so on. And I sort of drifted into trying to then ask a much more difficult question, which is, why are we as a globe, why are we as a global community, all at the same time, even though we have different cultures, different backgrounds, different histories, different everything, why is everybody feeling the same way? And so what I'm about to share with you isn't as a result of some kind of strange genius. It's something I sort of fell into by accident. Does that make sense? Just people saying, ooh, this seems to be what's going on here. Now, the reason why I say that is that inevitably, when we get into the Q&A, we're going to ask some very specific questions, probably about justice. Because what tends to happen with what I'm speaking about is that we're aware of injustices that we're currently going through and of our own historical narrative. Does that make sense? And we use our historical narrative to explain why we all feel the way that we do. And that's very, there's nothing wrong with that. But if our own individual histories, does that make sense? If the history of the UK, or the history of UK and Europe, or if the history of North America, or if the history of South Africa, or if the history of, can explain why everyone in that country is feeling that way, what it can't do is explain why everybody else in every other country is feeling the same way. In other words, it's true. There's something real there, but there's something even bigger there. In a sense, it can't be the cause. What's gone wrong in British history, for example, can't be causing all the anger in China. Because where's the shared history? So I'm mentioning this right up front because inevitably, as soon as you start talking about the kind of thing I want to talk about, it's going to raise some very, very specific questions. But I'm almost inviting us to step back and try and take an even bigger global picture. And I'm going to try and root some of what I say in an ancient historical case in which I think most of you don't feel you have any vested interest. So it allows us to look at a distance. Does that make sense? A group of people who lived at a different time in a different place. But I would like to flag up, in one sense, what I'm going to be talking about tonight is really quite serious. Because the kinds of trends that I'm talking about tonight always, always, without fail, either lead to civil war or war between countries. And therefore, these narratives I'm about to talk about have happened from time to time throughout history, and they have always led to war. What is unusual, what is very unusual, is we've never had everyone in the world at the same time all feeling the same way. And that means if those things spin out, then the question, is there a future for humanity, isn't one that we need to answer, because there won't be any humans left for us to be worried about their future. We will successfully take all of each other out. So that isn't enough to make you go and get drunk tonight. Or you're thinking that maybe you're now feeling so depressed you're going to go to the casino and just gamble away whatever debt you have remaining. assuming that you're not there, let's just try and ask then some of the bigger questions about where we are and what on earth is going on. You'll see on the invitation, one of the other things that happened in the UK, when I was thinking about this as a UK problem, and I'm sure you're all very familiar with this narrative, is there was this big debate about Germaine Greer, who made various comments, which I am not going to repeat, where she used lots of four-letter words, which I'm not allowed to use as a Christian. Although if I did use them and you were offended, because you're also a Christian, you'll have to forgive me anyway, because that's your job. She used those words to describe various issues that were going on in the transsexual community. And as a result, there was a debate at Cardiff University, because she was meant to be going to give a speech there in a month's time, about whether she should be allowed to come. So the debate was, should we no-platform her or not? And some people were pushing very hard, she shouldn't be allowed to speak. And at this point, a guy you've probably never, ever heard of in your entire life, called Professor Richard Dawkins, who keeps an amazingly low profile as an academic, he held a press conference in which he basically... a guy called Peter Tatchell, who you may well have heard of, who's very well known in this country, probably the most outspoken, long-lasting gay rights activist that the UK actually has. I mean, there may be people more high-profile and more long-lasting than him, but his name is certainly the one that always comes to the front of my mind. Peter Tatchell had a press conference in which he basically said, look, you can't ban Germaine Greer from coming to speak at your university. You should allow her to speak, and you should go along and disagree with her and ask her difficult questions. That's what we do. And after he held this press conference, a second motion was timetabled to debate whether Peter Tatchell should be no-platformed for speaking at Cardiff University. And amongst other things he was accused of being homophobic. And I have to say that the day I read that in one of the national press, I remember thinking, wow, I wonder how Peter Tatchell feels today. I don't know him at all. But I would imagine that someone spent his whole life campaigning on one issue. Does that make sense then to be accused of actually hating the very people he's trying to make a case for? It must have hit him pretty hard. Anyway, the day after that, that's when Richard Dawkins decided to hold his press conference, and he weighed into the debate. And he basically said that, in his humble opinion, any group of students anywhere in the world who could look at Peter Tatchell and conclude he was homophobic were so thick, they should never have been allowed to go to university in the first place. And any students who were thinking of having Germaine Greer banned, you know, should basically be forcibly removed from their academic institution. Also using lots of choice four-letter words that the Beeb blanked out for us, so we didn't have to hear them. At which point it was then mooted that maybe Richard Dawkins should be no platform from speaking at British universities, because he was now guilty of now supporting hate speech across campuses. At this point, a guy called Sir Brian Cox, I don't know if any of you are familiar with him, he held a press conference in which he said, look, you can't ban Professor Richard Dawkins from speaking at universities. He is sort of like a pretty well-known academic, and it would be really weird if you actually allowed that to happen. And that then, of course, started then another debate about whether Brian Cox should not be allowed. And I remember I was reading all of this at the time thinking, where is all of this going? What is actually happening here? Because these are the kinds of things that happen when temperatures are running really high. And the question is, what's happening? Now, we can talk about the causes of what leads to this in more detail if you want to in the Q&A. But generally speaking, we tend to feel this aggrieved and this angry when we feel that some massive injustice has been done. When justice collapses in any society, hope collapses with it. And either we feel we have to take matters into our own hand to get what's been denied us or delayed to us, or we actually begin to feel that there's actually no hope at all. And when faced with hopeless situations, we'll often take desperate measures and we become increasingly angry. Now, the question then is why is it that all of a sudden everything like this is being poured out? Now, we live in a culture where we love to be affirmed. I mean, that's true for almost every culture of the world. We want people to affirm us. The trouble is that we've now confused two very separate categories of love and affirmation. So we very now assume that to love someone is always to affirm them. And I guess one of the things I'm going to be asking today is it the case that love ever says no? Is it possible to actually love someone and say no to them? I mean, when my five-year-old daughter, Lucy, came to me and asked if she could borrow the electric drill, and I said no, she took it pretty hard. She felt, as a loving father who normally gave her most things she wanted, why was I now denying her? You know, but I wasn't denying her because I hated her. I loved her deeply. Now, it didn't matter that she wanted to play dentist with my three-year-old son, James. The answer was still no, even though she was feeling frustrated in it. Is there a time when love will actually step into any situation and look at someone and say, actually, no, I don't think that's the right thing? If we equate all forms of disagreement in any culture with hatred, we have a huge problem straight off the bat. Because it means when anyone disagrees with us or says, well, no, I don't think that's right, our conclusion has to be, well, maybe you hate me. Now, this has led into a very, very, very controversial area, but I'm going to just step back just a little bit and just describe two very broad categories that by which we have historically tried to analyze global cultures. And generally speaking, in that kind of cultural field, we often tend to contrast what we call dignity-based cultures with honor-based cultures. And roughly, it's 30% in one category and 70% in the other. Now, those categories are very broad, and they subdivide into other categories. And just like when you start studying anything, you start to get all these kinds of qualifications, and then you have to qualify the qualifications until your original thesis dies the death of 1,000 qualifications. But generally speaking, they've been very helpful terms. Now, in honor-based cultures, the way they tend to operate is if you were to attack me and criticize me and come after me, I will respond in a way to defend my honor. Does that make sense? So let's suppose you make up something about me that isn't true. I will now respond to you. It's going to be public. Make sense? I'm going to go and defend my honor. And the key thing is I have to do it honorably. Okay, I can't go crying off to Jeremy. It's Jeremy, right? I'm sorry, I'm a little tired, a bit of jet lag. Don't want to start getting... I've misnamed all kinds of people in the last few weeks. I can't go crying off to Jeremy because he's stronger and more powerful than me and say, Jeremy, I need you to go and beat up these guys for me. Because if word gets out, does that make sense? That's an honorable response. It's not just that I have to defend my honor, I have to do it in an honorable way. And if I do that, if you attack me and I respond with honor and in an honorable manner, your respect for me will actually go up. You will look at me and you'll think, wow, that was a good way to respond to that. And traditionally, in honor-based cultures, therefore, you look for leaders, does that make sense, who embody this, who somehow encapsulate this sense of honor and live it out. Now, we'll contrast that with a dignity-based culture. In a dignity-based culture, if you were to attack me and come after me, even if what you're saying isn't true, does that make sense? If I suffer some kind of injustice at your hand, in a dignity-based culture, I may decide to say nothing publicly at all. Because that may sort of lack dignity. Does that make sense? I might decide just to come to you individually, take you aside, sit you down and say, look, what's the issue? And if we can talk and finally get it all resolved and I come out and say, okay, look, we've had a long talk, everything's fine, let's all move on now, that will be seen as a dignified response. Make sense? I've protected my dignity and I've acted with dignity. And as a result of the injustice I've suffered, so long as I act in a dignified way, it may actually be that my respect, my esteem goes up. Now, increasingly, you're going to hear people talking about victim-based cultures. Now, I'm not a particular fan of this word. The reason we have this word victim is because it comes from the school academic field of psychology. And I'm going to delve into that in a little bit. Because when we hear that word victim, we think bad. Does that make sense? I'm about to talk about something bad. Victim-based cultures, in one sense, are no bad or worse than honor or dignity-based cultures. You can have honor killings in honor cultures, and they're not a good thing. Does that make sense? So you're going to have to overcome some of the language just a little bit here. But in victim-based cultures, the reason why we borrowed that term from psychology is if you attack me, okay, you do something wrong to me, I have suffered injustice. In a victim-based culture, I began to think of myself and define myself as a victim. So let's try to deal with something very, very difficult straight off the bat. Why is it that if someone, for example, has been raped, attacked and raped, and they go for counseling, one of the things the counselors will try and do is train that person to say, I am not a victim? Now, it sounds very strange to the untrained ear. Does that make sense? Why would you do that? They are not saying, you need to pretend this didn't happen. That isn't helpful to them or anyone else. That's what they're not saying. They are not saying, it doesn't really matter. Okay? That's not helpful to them or to anyone else. That is not what they're saying. What they're saying to the person who's been attacked is, look, if you cannot allow this to define you. You are more precious, more wonderful, and more valuable than that. And if you allow this terrible injustice which has befallen you to define you, you're allowing this person who did this to steal from both who you are and also to determine your future. And you can't allow that to happen. And even if you have to live with the pain of it for the rest of your life, let's try to at least find a way in which you can be put in a place now where you can actually live, don't make sense, the rest of your life and have an identity which is separate from the terrible injustice you suffered. If we can't do that, does that make sense? If we can't overcome that, then that trauma becomes a core part of our identity. And we feel imprisoned by it. Now, the reason why, when people are counseling people who've suffered, therefore, huge injustices, the reason why they're trying to tell them, don't think this way, is because they care for the person. So you have two different things going on here. One is pastoral care for the individual. Look, you have been wronged, and what has fallen to you is terrible. You mustn't allow this to define who you are. You mustn't allow this to determine the rest of your future. If you do that, then you're giving this person who did this terrible thing a much bigger victory than they need to have. You have a life ahead of you. You are more precious than this. So at that level, does that make sense? You're trying to encourage them, don't think this way. But on the justice issue, well, that's slightly different. Does that make sense? You're training them, I'm not a victim, but at the same time, you're trying to think, how do we do justice here? What can we do to find the person who did this? What can we do to actually make sure that they actually have to stand account? What happens, okay, if we find them? Are we actually going to be able to lock them away and convict them? That's the pursuit of justice. And ideally, you get both. But the key thing is, if one of those fails, even if you don't find justice, that makes sense, you can rescue the individual. They've still got a future ahead of them. Now, when you understand it that way, then that's, if you like, where then the negative side of victimhood thinking can come in. You're allowing something to define you that shouldn't define you. You're building it into a core part of your identity. And this can happen not just at an individual level, this can happen at a national level. I don't know how many of you are interested in history, but way back in the late 1300s, early 1400s, around the Balkan area of Europe, there was a whole series of running battles between the Balkan states and the Ottoman Empire that was extending into the area at the time. And there was a prince from Kosovo called Prince Lazar who was involved in a whole series of running battles with the then Ottoman rulers. And depending on which history books you read and depending on who you believe, okay, will depend on who's ultimately at fault here, but Prince Lazar died. Okay? One way or another, he died. Now, whether he was killed on the battlefield or killed in captivity, okay, well, we'll allow history to debate that. But the key thing is, everyone agreed, he was definitely dead. And as with most dead people, he was buried. And as the Ottoman Empire spread, they moved the body, the hero, the greatest hero in the eyes of the Kosovans, to a safe place. And they longed to return the body back to their capital city. But it was denied to them. And then in the 1800s, when the Austro-Hungarian Empire sort of came to its zenith, the people of Kosovo applied to the then emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, please return the body to us, and he refused. Now, the people sang songs about Prince Lazar. They told stories about them. If you went, when you went to school, you were told the story about him from the age of 4, 5, 6 years old, young kids. You sang hymns, you celebrated his birthday. As a matter of fact, it defined the nation. They were known as a nation of mourners, mourning the death of Prince Lazar, and when would the body be returned? And because the emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire refused the return of the body on the 500th anniversary of his death, a young Kosovan decided he'll take matters into his own hand and decide he would assassinate the emperor's son, Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Now, I don't know how much of you know your history, but that event sparked the First World War, and millions of people died. On the 600th anniversary of the death of Prince Lazar, the now ruler of Kosovo, a guy by the name of Slobodan Milosevic, promised the nation, if it was the last thing he did, he would return the body to the city. They were able to get the body. It went on a national tour around the country to every village, every town, and every city, in which he said, this injustice will finally be put right. And then on the 600th anniversary to the day of the killing, when he erected a statue of Lazar and they reburied the body, he announced that now they would finally get their own back. And the genocide began. When we allow historical traumas, even ones which happened over 500 years ago, to become a core part of our identity, when that is violated, we will always respond. Make sense? Out of that hurt victim mentality, even though it never happened to us personally, it happened 600 years ago, in order to make sure that we get our own back. So these events that we're talking about are actually huge. And the way they play out in the history of our planet are massive. And the question is, what's going on? Now, here's what I do find interesting. And this is very unusual. Normally, most of our superheroes, the people that we really look up to, you know, and admire, are amazing types of characters. You see, they're all so young. Have any of you seen the original Superman movie? 1986, Christopher Reeves, 1, 2, 3. Okay, some of you. Okay, great. Now, for those of you who haven't, just to enlighten you, let me ask the guys who've seen the movie, what were the original Superman's weaknesses? Apart from kryptonite. Now, you see, he was morally perfect, physically perfect, rationally perfect, perfect, calm, cool, caring, thoughtful, kind, understanding, beautiful, handsome. He reminds me of me every time I think of him. I mean, that's why he was a superhero. Okay? He could fly. He was perfect. Have any of you seen Man of Steel? The millennial remake of Superman. How does that movie start? Superman is lost in a thick fog on a small boat in the middle of the ocean, struggling with his sense of identity, struggling with his sense of worth. He feels cosmically abandoned, cosmically lonely, misunderstood, unable to deal with the weight of expectation that's now being dumped upon him. To be a superhero today, Superman needs a victim narrative. Because that's how he connects with his global audience. That's what makes him a hero. Every single Marvel superhero movie, have you seen it in the Marvel? If you watch Marvel movies, don't be ashamed. Just put up your hand. I mean, what percentage of you? Shame on you. What a waste of time. I only watch movies like this because I have to do cultural research and analysis. And so that's why the only reason why I watch that. Rubbish. Every Marvel superhero, they have all been used, abused, hurt, betrayed, abandoned. Every single one of them are victims. Even, in my mind, the most boring superhero ever conceived of, Captain America. In order for him to have a sequel, how does the second movie have to start? Betrayed by his country, betrayed by his friends, abandoned, hurt, lost of love. He needs a victim narrative. He was just too perfect. He needs a victim narrative to be a superhero. All of the heroes we worship around the world today are victims. And most of us become like that which we worship. So we are living at this very unusual time globally. Now, that's not to say that, therefore, there aren't historical injustices that need to be put right. There are. But remember, we're talking about two different narratives here. One is, how do you pastorally hurt the person who suffered massive injustice so they can live a good life? And the second one, then, which is equally important, even though I won't be spending as much time on it, how do you fight to put those injustices right? You have to answer that question as well. But we're focusing on the first one just for the purposes of this evening, because I'm trying to cram an awful lot of thought into a very small amount of space. Now, I said I was going to put forward before you a real historical example, and that's what I would like to do. And I'm going to take it. Actually, should I take a real historical example? Okay, this is what's called audience participation. You have a vote. Okay, I'm going to allow you to vote one of two ways. So they might both end up in the same place, we'll see. Option one is we'll take an ancient historical example and we'll look at what was going on. Okay. Option two is Jesus Christ answered this question head on. About a year ago, I met with one of the leaders of one of the largest terrorist organizations in the world, and we were talking about exactly what we're talking about now. And so either I can share with you what I shared with him, which is option two, okay, or we can take the old historical example, which is option one. So let's do a vote. Who wants option one? Hands in the air. Option two. Okay, all right, okay. All right, democracy. Let's go with option one. Now, okay, let's take option two. This then raises a very serious question. Because here's the challenge that we face in our world. The idea of a country is a relatively recent idea. By relatively recent, I mean a couple of thousand years old. Okay, it's not much more than that. The further in history you go back, you don't find countries, you find fiefdoms. So it makes sense, a king with a set of villages around him. You go back further than that, you basically had like city-states, Athens, Corinth, Troy. You go further back than that, that makes sense, it keeps breaking down. So you take any history, any country, and you look at their history, it breaks down into lots of little pieces. Now, there was a book written by a guy called Ishiguro. I don't know if any of you have read any Ishiguro. He wrote Remains of the Day, which was made into a film. You may have seen that. I love Ishiguro. He writes a book maybe once every 5 or 6 years. He does a huge amount of research, and he normally wins millions of prizes every single time he publishes a book. I mean, I have come to the conclusion he's a very greedy man, because I think no one author should win as many global prizes as he has won. Seems grossly unfair. He should share them around with sort of lesser authors. But the book he wrote 4 or 5 years ago was absolutely panned by the critics. They hated it. It was called The Buried Giant. And as a matter of fact, the reviews of it were so negative, I almost didn't bother reading it, because I'd loved all of his other books, and I thought, well, if this one isn't worth reading, I won't. But I was in the airport one day, and I was about to fly halfway around the world. I think I was going to Hong Kong or something like that. And I was looking for a big book, because that's 13 hours of flying time there, and then 13 hours back. So you need a big book. Okay, that's 26 hours. And here's this big fat book by Ishiguro sat on the bookshelf, and I'm thinking, that looks just about long enough for a 26-hour of travel. And I think it's brilliant. The reason the critics hate it is the book moves so slowly. I mean, literally, you wonder if someone's half asleep, but the pace of the book is married to the pace of the characters. It starts off with this very elderly couple, and they can't remember the past. They can't even remember if they've had children. They think they may have done, but they're not sure. If there are young parents in the room and you've suffered sleep deprivation, you'll realize this. But normally, you grow out of that stage and you do remember when your grandparents are normally who you've had. So they set out on a quest to recover their memory. And as they set out on this quest, they meet an old knight and a young boy and a fit warrior. And this very unlikely band sort of travel around trying to find what's gone wrong. And towards the end of the book, they find the source of their forgetfulness. Now, I'm not going to ruin the end for you. But as they find the source of their forgetfulness, they find what's making everybody forget. They suddenly now think we should do the obvious. We should help everybody recover their memory. And the warrior speaks up. And the warrior says, if you do this, if you overcome the source of forgetfulness in this country, people remember the past, and quick-tongued men will make ancient grievance rhyme with current complaint, and the result will be war and mayhem. In other words, let everyone forget. Because as soon as we remember all of the historical injustices that have happened down through the generations, we'll all start killing each other again. So surely better not to be able to remember more than 2 weeks ago, because at least we have peace. And that is right at the heart. The buried giant, in that sense, in the book, in my sense, it's allegorical. We have a buried giant in our personal histories, in our family history, in our national history. And the question is, if we remember it, can we live at peace or not? Is it actually possible to be reconciled? Now, interestingly, Jesus Christ did answer this question head on. And he told an incredibly well-known story. You can go home and read it on your own if you want to. Just get online and just type in Luke 15. You'll find the story he told. But Jesus told a story about a man who had two sons. It's sometimes called the story of the prodigal son. But actually, it's a story about a man and two sons, and we know that because Jesus said there was a man and he had two sons, and that sort of implies there were two rather than one. And he said, what happened is the younger one came to his father and said, hey, I want my money now. I've basically been waiting for you to die for a while. To my disappointment, you're still here. So look, just give me the cash and I'll leave. Now, it doesn't matter what cultural background you're from. It doesn't matter if you're Middle Eastern, African, Asian. That's pretty insulting. Make sense? To basically come to your dad and say, look, I'm so disappointed you're not dead yet. And I just can't wait any longer, so just give me the cash. That's all I'm interested in, and I'll go. that doesn't tend to go down too well. So when Jesus told this story, you're asking yourself, as soon as the younger boy says this, what should happen next? Now, he's got an older brother. Now, I don't know what your family dynamics are like. I have a Middle Eastern family dynamic. I'm the eldest. That means if my two younger brothers do something stupid, okay, my father rings me, and my job is to go and beat up on them, metaphorically speaking, I'd like to add. I'm half Greek. Well, the Greeks split genetically into two family trees. Okay, half of us are built like the Greek gods, you know, like the statues you see, and the rest of us are built like Greek restaurants. And I'm from the restaurant side of that genetic family. Okay? So metaphorically, I go, does that make sense? I dress them down, does that make sense? That's my job. So what you're expecting to happen next in the story is either the father produces a big stick, after all, he is a Near Eastern patriarch, and beats the boy for insolence, or the older brother steps in, does that make sense? And he rebukes his brother and pleads with mercy. But one of those two happens. But then something incredible happens. Jesus said the father took everything he had and divided it between them. He actually gives to the older and to the younger their inheritance up front. Now, this is unthinkable. The older son doesn't say, Father, I will not bring disgrace on my family by doing this. This is an honor-based culture. He wants the money too. He's just too scared to ask for it. The younger one runs away. The older one stays at home. And the question in everybody's mind is, this family is shattered for the rest of its life. There's no way back from this. Now, the younger boy, he goes off, Jesus said, and he loses everything. Okay? He lives very expensively. Okay? He indulges himself in the best things. He lives very lavishly. And then famine comes on the land and he has nothing. Okay? He's starving to death. And he says to himself, here I am starving to death. He's thinking about his stomach. This is a very Middle Eastern story. And then he says to himself, nobody will even give me the food that they're feeding the pigs to eat. Now, he doesn't want to eat the pig. Okay? He's Jewish, so that's out. But he would like to eat the pig food. But they won't even give him the food they're feeding to the pigs. So he says, they won't even give me the food they're feeding to the pigs. So he's still thinking with his stomach. And he says to himself, I know what I'll do. I'll go back to my father and I will say, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm not worthy to be called your son. Make me like a hired servant. Now that word there, hired servant, there are three categories of word you can use, and it's the top one. It basically means that you have a skill, that you should be paid, you should have housing, and you'll be fed off the estate. I mean, since your food is free, your housing is free, and you get a salary on top. Now, what do the hired servants have, therefore, that he doesn't have? Well, food. He's thinking with his stomach. So that's what's going on in his heart and mind. And he says, I know what, I'll go back to my father, and I say, I've sinned against heaven, and I've sinned against you. Now, that sounds very impressive. If someone came to you and said, I'm so sorry, I've sinned against heaven and against you, please forgive me. My guess is this day and age, you'll go, wow, that's sort of like eloquent. Okay, let me just get my Twitter account out. This is worth retweeting. Except that's not how the audience would have heard it then. There's a very famous person in Jewish history called Pharaoh. And he took all the Israelites and he imprisoned them for 400 years and treated them like dirt. And Moses came to Pharaoh and said, you need to let my people go. And a series of plagues came. And after every plague, Pharaoh came to Moses and said, Moses, I've sinned against heaven and against you. Please forgive me. I'll let you go. If any of you know that story, what do you know about that story? When Pharaoh said, I've sinned against heaven and against you, did he mean it or not? He didn't mean it. He never let the people go. So this son is going to quote some of the most insincere words ever spoken in his national history and use them to get back in favor with his father. And all the time, he's thinking about this. And then the story says, and when he was still a long way off, the father saw him, had compassion on him, ran to him, put his arms around him, and kissed him. Now, I know for those of you who are English, this is a very multinational audience, but if you're English, you're taught, when you see someone, even if you haven't seen them for 25 years, you walk up to them and you shake their hand. Yeah. It's great to see you after all of this time. Okay? In the Middle East, if you haven't seen someone for 2 minutes and you see them again, you give them a kiss. Okay? I mean, that's what you do. And kissing is quite important. A slave will fall on his face and kiss his master's feet. That's what a slave would do. A student would bend down on one knee, take his teacher's hand, and kiss the hand. And in case you're wondering in this setting, I'm the teacher, you're my students, so there you go. However, brothers, equals, friends, you embrace each other. And when you embrace them, you kiss either on the neck or on the cheek. And it's not just like, you know, one little kiss. You know, it's multiple. It's a sign of peace. Everything's okay between you. So the son is coming back and all he's doing is thinking about his stomach. And before the son speaks, Jesus said, the father ran out to him, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The father offers him peace and forgiveness even before he speaks. And at this point, the son starts to speak, and he says, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm not worthy to be called your son. And he stops. He can't even finish the sentence he prepared. Make me like a hired servant. Because for the first time in his life, he realizes the issue is actually not the spent money. The issue is the broken relationship he has with his dad. And his father is offering him forgiveness even before he thought of asking for it. The offer of forgiveness that brings reconciliation is a very interesting thing. If I insult you, and now I want to make peace with you, two things have to happen, right? Number one, I have to be willing to say, I'm sorry, I was wrong. And number two, you have to be willing to forgive me. If I insult you and you're not willing to forgive me, even if I want to say sorry, there's no peace. Does that make sense? Similarly, if you want to forgive me, but I'm not willing to say sorry, I can't receive the peace you're extending to me. But do you see the dynamic? The father extends peace and forgiveness to the son, and the son says sorry, and when he says sorry, he receives the peace that's been offered. But here's the key thing. The peace and the forgiveness is offered before the apology is given. Peace and forgiveness comes first. I'm willing to forgive. And the son says, I'm sorry. And as soon as he does that, he receives it. And it's the most incredible thing in the world. I don't know if you've ever insulted a friend or something like that, and you've gone to apologize, and they say it's nothing. It's amazing. The very next day you see them, you know if everything's okay. You could be stood here. They could be all the way over there by that door. You look at them. You need one nanosecond. One glance will tell you, have they forgiven me or not? If they have, it's amazing. If they haven't, you can feel it, even at that distance. And the father brings the younger son home. Well, the older son is out in the field, and he hears what's happened. And as he comes back, he hears there's a party going on because they've killed a fatted calf. And a fatted calf, I don't know if any of you have a farming background. A fat calf feeds a lot of people. There's what, 100 people in this room? Okay? It will feed all of you, or 8 Americans, depending on how much red meat you're used to eating. But it feeds a lot of people, okay? So the father kills an animal which is big enough to feed his entire community. Does that make sense? And he starts to celebrate. And the older boy, as he comes back in from the fields, he says, I can hear the celebration. I can smell the food. What's going on? And the little boy says, and notice it, the little boy says, your father has killed the fatted calf because your father has received back your brother with peace. The little boy puts the emphasis on the father. Something amazing happened, he says. Your brother came back, and instead of your father beating him like he should have done, he ran to him, he offered him forgiveness, he received it, and now he's celebrating that he received the peace he offered. And the older son becomes angry with the father, and he refuses to go into the house. Now, I'm sure your family aren't like my crazy Middle Eastern family. Okay? And I'm sure your family never have disputes and disagreements and get angry with each other. But my family, we're from that part of the world, that's what tends to happen. But you pick your moment for the fight. Does that make sense? You don't wait until Christmas Day when your parents have all of their friends, all their bosses and everyone round to their house for a drink, and you stand outside the house yelling and you refuse to go in. I mean, if that happened, that tells you something, right? Does that make sense? I mean, that's clear. You hate whoever is in that room. You won't even go through the door. So the older son is that mad. The older son is that mad that his father has forgiven someone who he thinks is unforgivable. So now the father comes out, and again, this is what you should expect to hear. Does that make sense? This is a Middle Eastern story. The father comes out with a big stick, bashes his older son over the head, says, we'll talk about this later, but not now, get in the house. Okay, that's what he should say. The father now pleads with the older son. He pleaded with the younger son, now he pleads with the older one. And he says, everything I have is yours. And the older son says, I've been slaving for you all of these years, literally. You've treated me like a slave. You didn't give me anything. Not even a young goat. Now, I find that part interesting because I don't know if you've ever eaten young goat, but it is like... Oh. young goat is... if you've never eaten young goat, you're being deprived, okay? So look. So when he says, you didn't even give me a young goat, he's not saying, hey, you didn't even give me, like, the rubbish. That makes sense? He's saying, you didn't even give me, like, the best. Okay? But how did this story start? The father took everything he had and gave it to both of his kids. So the older son was given everything. Does that make sense? I mean, his father held nothing back. He was given everything. And the father, instead of him yelling at him, says, everything I have, I've given you. And then the older brother says, but this younger brother of mine, when he's been sleeping with prostitutes, comes back. You kill the fatted calf for him. In other words, how can you condone this kind of injustice? Now, that statement is really telling. Why? Well, the way Jesus told the story, the younger brother lives extravagantly. Does that make sense? Nice clothes, top-of-the-range camel, two humps, silk grains, you know, gold hoofs. Okay, he lived expensively, right? There's no implied immorality in that sense. Does that make sense? That the older brother's just making that up. I mean, how does the brother know that? I mean, does the older brother have access to CIA keyhole spies, satellite photography? He's been sent, you know, intelligence reports back about what's going on. And I mean, the CIA know a lot. And if you're watching, I really love you very much. he has no access to that information. He's just making that up. He is so angry, he's making stuff up. I don't know if you've ever been so angry with somebody. You make up things about them that you want to be true. That's what happens when you start thinking as a victim. That's why it's so destructive. You've wronged me, and you deserve everything I said and everything else that could be true, and I'm going to make it true, and I'll say it's true, and if I take you down, I'll feel good about it afterwards. And that's the interesting psychological thing. When you think this way, you don't wake up guilty the next morning saying, I wish I hadn't lost my temper. You wake up feeling good about it because you're sure they deserved it. And the father says, we had to celebrate. He was dead, and now he's alive. He was lost and is found. And the story ends there, which leaves you with one question, doesn't it? How did the older son respond to that? And when Jesus told the story, he invites his hearers to write their own ending to it. Now, I'm an optimist. I like happy endings to stories, okay? That's why I like American movies rather than French ones, but I watch both. I like it when everyone survives, okay? I really love those stories. But there's another possibility, which is the older son maintains his anger and he never goes in. Now, there are two things that come out of this. Number one, Jesus is talking about himself in this story. If you read Luke 15 very carefully, some religious people come to Jesus and they complain about him. You welcome sinners and prostitutes and tax collectors and you eat with them. How can you sit and eat with these people? And Jesus then tells a story that has three parts. So there's one about a lost sheep, one about a lost coin, and then this one about two lost sons. At the end of which, of each part, Jesus sits down with that which is lost and eats with them. So they're saying, how can you condone what this person has done wrong and extend fellowship to them? Jesus, what you're doing is wrong. And then he tells a story, the end of which the key person sits down with those things which were lost, does that make sense? Eats with them and extends fellowship to them. He's talking about himself. And Jesus is saying, I've come in here to make this reconciliation possible. And this is how I'm doing it. And that's why you'll sometimes hear Christians talk about the idea of grace. Grace is when you decide to forgive someone even when they don't deserve it. But it's very counterintuitive. Because in every culture of the world, forgiveness is earned. And on this, we'll finish, and then we'll go into Q&A. Well, what do I mean by that? Look, let's suppose in the Q&A, which we're about to have, you ask me a question, and I look at you and I say, what a stupid question. You have the intellectual capacity more commonly associated with forms of pond life, which are invisible to the naked eye, which is Blackadder, in case you're wondering where that comes from. And for some strange reason, you take my response to you to be insulting. So imagine I've insulted you in this way in front of everybody here, and you're stunned. Okay? And at the end of the evening, you're still sat in your chair. You still can't believe I singled you out, humiliated you in that kind of way. And as I walk out to go back home, I pat you on the shoulder as I leave and I say, please forgive me for what I said earlier. And I walk out the back door. Now, be honest. Would you forgive me? No. Okay? You will not forgive me. We normally forgive people when we feel they've suffered enough. So let's suppose I publicly humiliate you. And then 2 seconds later, as soon as I finish speaking, my bottom lip begins to tremble. My eyes fill up with tears. I collapse on this platform. I start sobbing uncontrollably. I drag myself with my hands across the floor to where you're sitting. I hold onto your ankles. And through the sobs and the wailing, I beg you to forgive me. Now do you forgive me? Now I see some of you are very hard to please. The answer is, you will forgive me when you think I've suffered enough. Does that make sense? When I've paid enough for what I have done, that's when you'll forgive me. And that's the basis on which most of us are looking to forgive other people. But Jesus says something very different. The message of what we call the Christian gospel isn't if you come to God and beg him to forgive you and you're really sorry and you feel really guilty, he may forgive you. That's not it at all. The message is much more radical than that. It is, even before we knew we'd done anything wrong, and even when we even hated the idea of him, he paid the price to make forgiveness possible and offers it to us as a gift. He offers peace and reconciliation and forgiveness as a gift. When you say sorry, you receive it. And there's an amazing peace that flows. But there's something interesting in the dynamic too, because it also has the capacity to make us incredibly angry. And that's what's going on in the older son's life. He's outraged by what he sees. A colossal failure of justice in his eyes. He wants his younger brother punished, all the time forgetting that he's guilty of the same thing. In the story that Jesus told, both of the characters refer to their father in terms of a servant-master relationship. Make sense? The younger brother, make me a hired servant. The older brother, I've been slaving for you all of these years. They're relating to the father as a servant relates to his master. It's completely transactional. But he's not interested in servants. He wants his kids back. He loves his children. And he wants his relationship with them back. And he's willing to pay the price to make that happen. And that, I think, becomes the basis on which we can see reconciliation take place, even in very divided communities. You've listened really well. So, well done.